Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Joe Stagner, former Microsoftie, current geek in the development engagement group at Mozilla. I'm not sure I got that right. Did I get that right, Joe?
Close enough.
I am really, really glad to have you on the show. I should say, full disclosure, that Joe acted as my godfather through my entire Microsoft career, guiding me into the MVP program and then dragging me, kicking and screaming, out to join Microsoft. And now we're both ex-Microsofties.
Which means you still haven't forgiven me for all of that?
Well, I'm getting there. It'll be a few more years. So what does it mean to be in the development engagement group?
Mozilla is a unique organization, and I think lots of folks don't understand what Mozilla is, and lots of folks that think they do probably don't, and I know I fell in that category when I first started talking to Mozilla. So Mozilla is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to catalyze the adoption of the open web and standards-based technologies. So a lot of people just think, you know, Mozilla is the Firefox company, and that's not true. Mozilla makes Firefox along with a collection of other products, but the products that they make are meant to facilitate the foundation's mission. So in developer engagement, what we do is try and help developers use open standards-based technologies to build the web under the premise that doing so will make the world a better place. And that sounds sort of almost contrived to say, but that's one of the things that was sort of really sort of dazzled me in my early exposures to people at Mozilla, was that, you know, this is an incredibly diverse group of people, from young to, you know, even, you know, incredibly ancient like myself, from all different walks of life and all different sort of, you know, political and belief orientations, all coming together and really believing that through their work they can improve the world. And you know, when I first went out and spent a day at the Mountain View headquarters, I thought, you know, these are great people. I'm not sure it's realistic. And in the 6 short months that I've been here, I'm actually seeing examples of, you know, of ways that people's lives get better because of the open web and availability to folks in all walks of life, in countries of all stages of development, to technology. You know, it's been a real sort of culture shock for me.
I was going to say the culture shock must have been fairly intense, coming from a commercial, almost the definition of a commercial organization.
We can be even more direct than that, right? Having spent a decade at the most ruthlessly commercial organization on the planet, to a truly philanthropic nonprofit foundation, you know, was real culture shock. And, you know, it's funny because Stormy Peters, who I work for and who's very well known in the open source community. And when I say open source, you know, in the sense of Stormy, it's really the, you know, free open source software ecosystem that she's known, and she headed the GNOME project. And so it's, you know, not just open source like, you know, PHP source available, but the real sort of philosophical open source world. And when I started work, I was only when I decided to leave Microsoft, I only interviewed seriously with open source organizations. That's really sort of where I wanted to go. And when I had originally interviewed with Mozilla about a competitive strategist position, because I'd done so much of that at Microsoft, and I went through several interview sort of steps and went out and spent a couple of days out in Mountain View. And they called me back the day after I got back from Mountain View, and they said, "Hey, we were talking and we think you'd be perfect for this other position." And that position happened to report to Stormy, who I had spoken with as one of a dozen interview conversations. And so she one of the things that she warned me about, she says, "You'll find it much harder to come up to speed and adapt yourself to Mozilla than you expect." And I sort of took that with a grain of salt. You know, when I went to work at Microsoft, my first manager told me the same thing about Microsoft. And I think I went on my first customer call 4 hours later. So I didn't really take her seriously, but it's really been true. Not just because the technology is different, but Mozilla does things in a very different way. And in fact, it's often shocking to me how much these guys get done with the way that they do things. And I'm working with incredibly bright people. I mean, you know, I work with Brendan Eich, who invented JavaScript. I mean, you know, how cool is that? And you know, and everybody at Mozilla, it's just an amazing repository of really smart people. But everything gets done in the open, and everything is done by democracy. So even like the stand-up meetings, I'm primarily focused on Mozilla's HTML5 apps initiative. So building real apps, not just web pages, but real apps that can install and run locally without an internet connection, but based on standards-based HTML5 technologies. And you know, in the stand-up meetings, anybody can join. Everybody has a chance to make requests for spec changes. So one of the things that happens is the Mozilla guys, the guys that are working on both the apps initiative and Boot2Gecko, which if you haven't heard of is equally amazing, they regularly collaborate with the Chrome team at Google, which you know, you would think is, you know, a conflict, right? That you know, we both make browsers, but that's just not the way the organization works. It's funny. I joke that that when I started at Mozilla, the way that Stormy asked me to do everything that I was doing, all would have gotten me fired at Microsoft.
That's quite a change. Tell me about Boot2Gecko. What is that?
So we announced Boot2Gecko at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, Spain last month. A bunch of the team, and myself included, went out and spent the week in Barcelona at Mobile World Congress, which is just ridiculous. It's like 60,000 people at a conference. And Boot2Gecko is basically an HTML5 native operating system running on a phone. And this is cool for a couple of reasons. So you know, one of the promises of HTML5 is, you know, we've been trying forever as a software development industry to come up with a way to write one set of source code and run it on every device. And for a while, that became less important because smartphones hadn't yet appeared and Windows was ubiquitous across the desktop. Well, now Windows still has majority market share, but there are statistically significant market shares on Mac and Linux. And there is more traffic that takes place on the internet today on smart devices like phones and tablets than on desktop computers. So one of the things that, you know, we're looking at is the fact that HTML5 or HTML runs on all of these devices that we want to connect. So if we can build an app based on that HTML5 technology and run it on all those devices, even if there have to be, you know, minor considerations on a per device basis, then, you know, that's the silver bullet for developers. So Boot2Gecko is an HTML5 based operating system for phones. That means that the apps that run on your desktop can easily be adapted to run on your phone. It also means a couple of things that are important. So the first thing is that because it's a dedicated phone operating system, it's very lightweight. So you can actually run Boot2Gecko and therefore HTML5 apps on lower powered devices. So the number I think I heard was that we did a deal with Telefonica, who's about to release phones later this year. And we'll have Boot2Gecko smartphones. We'll have a price point at somewhere around $99 US. And you know what that means is that folks in yet developing countries that don't have, you know, $500 or $300 to spend on a smartphone like an iPhone or a top of the line Android phone will still be able to afford to get smartphones that can consume applications over the web. I actually think that once Boot2Gecko has been in the wild for a little while, I think cell carriers will be able to, you know, at least cut that in half, if not drive the cost of a Boot2Gecko phone to pretty close to zero.
Sounds like some very exciting stuff. What other kinds of things are you working on?
Well, so the apps thing is where I spend most of my time. It was funny. I started, I had communicated with my manager at Microsoft about that I was interviewing, and then you know after 10 years it was time to leave. And when I got the offer, on the Thursday before the beginning of Mozilla's annual all hands meeting. So it all happened really quick. I got the offer on Thursday. I formalized my resignation from Microsoft on Friday. And on Monday I was on the West Coast at the first day of the all hands. And then so that lasted a whole week. And then the following Monday, I got diverted from the community job that I had signed up for to do partner engineering for the Mozilla apps team. And that's where I've spent most of my time, and I'm starting to step away from the partner engineering piece, but I'm still going to be focused on the apps initiative. And so the cool thing about that is we're building both a platform and a marketplace for HTML5 apps. And the platform is basically HTML5 with some extensions to allow you to install and run an app, an HTML5 app, with a more or less native experience on a device. So, for example, you know, if you install an HTML5 app on Windows, then you get a start menu item that you can use to launch that application. And if you install it on a Mac, you can go to the launcher and install that app. And so that's, you know, that's where I'm spending most of my time.
Tell me about your involvement with the open source community and what that's about. What don't I know about the open source community that I should?
I did a lot of work with the open source community, or at least I thought I did, at Microsoft. I did a lot with of PHP work and some Python work and a little bit less in the Ruby on Rails space, and mostly just because I was interested, especially in the PHP world. I really liked the apps that were coming out of that space. But I always felt like that work was, it was valuable to some folks, but it was still really centric to Microsoft's goals around the adoption of the Windows Server and Windows in the web workload space. At Mozilla, it's very different, and I'll be the first to admit that I still don't fully grok what it all means. But it's a lot more than just published source code, which is, I think what a lot of folks tend to think of open source as. So, for example, our daily status reports go to a public mailing list. So if you're interested in finding out what we're doing, you can follow along. All of our work, our documentation, even our very early stuff, goes on a public wiki or a public etherpad. So it's open, in the total sense of the word, which is, I wrote a blog post and sent it to my team asking for a request for comments. And the first comment I got back was, why didn't you write this on a Mozilla wiki? I said, well, because it's not ready to publish yet. I want comments. And they said, well, yeah, so do the draft someplace public and ask the rest of the world for comments. And that just hasn't been part of my thinking. But the end result, I think, is that, you get to do things that are of use to the broadest possible audience.
That's an extraordinary mindset to do the draft in an open wiki and get feedback from potential readers. And then to refine from there. It's not the way we're used to doing business.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm finding is that there's a different sort of tone in the community. I've been doing a blog for 8 or 9 years, and I'm just finding that there's a, because the whole nature is sort of social in terms of how open source development works. You hear a lot of people say, that's a harsh, the community's harsh. And I suppose that there are projects where that's true, but I'm finding the opposite to be true, that folks, when I do something wrong in a blog post, the response is not, hey, I'm smarter than you, here's what you did wrong. It's, everybody really is trying to help. I'm stunned at the level of interaction. So, as from your time at Microsoft, one of the tough things about working with the developer community on products that are not yet released is that the documentation, there's either no documentation or it's wrong because it's antiquated, and things are changing at an incredibly rapid pace. So it's really difficult because you have to track down the guys that are actually working on the stuff that you need to write about to get the details right. And, I've worked at places where that was difficult to do because, of course, everybody has their own job to get done. One of the things that's amazing to me is that, the guys that are leading these projects at Mozilla, I send them an email and, I get a detailed response the same day with links to internal, documents. And so that's kind of a cool feeling, even though I often feel like I'm stumbling trying to, be effective in this culture that I don't really understand. It's cool to feel like everybody has the best end result in, as their goal.
What other Mozilla projects can you talk openly about?
Well, I can talk openly about anyone that I know about because we're completely open, right? Which is weird, right? For us, right? I mean, I remember when I was working on some of the developer story for Windows 8, I couldn't even tell you guys, other guys on my team, what I was working on.
Yes, I remember.
So those are the two things that I'm primarily focused on, are the whole apps ecosystem and Buttigieg. Of course, you know, Mozilla is both the foundation and the company, which is wholly owned by the foundation. And I don't really understand the specifics. It has something to do with accounting and tax law and all of that stuff. So another thing that is sort of tangential to the apps platform stuff is the marketplace itself. So, you know, one of the things that's sort of fun at Mozilla is that people sit around at tables and talk about really big problems to solve. And as smartphones and apps started to, you know, reach critical mass, they started doing a lot of thinking about what were the barriers, what were the pain points relative to apps on the consumer side. And there were lots, right? So of course, you know, we're all, you know, at Mozilla, you know, everybody sort of has the geeky gene. So, you know, we talk a lot about what developers need, but also about what, you know, consumers need. And, you know, there are things that came out that some app stores are really restrictive for developers. And so that creates problems for developers being able to get apps in or to generate revenue the way that they want. There are other app acquisition channels that are sort of have no curation process, so they're very free and open, but they're flooded with stuff that's of, you know, not necessarily of significant quality, or at least it's difficult for end users to figure out, you know, what's good and what's maybe not so good. Mm. So one of the interesting things at Mozilla is we have lots of folks that focus on user experience and how to really get value out of user experience. You know, which for an old mainframe guys, you know, that's kind of a cool thing, right? Because when I started writing software, it was, you know, we had that adage that, you know, users should be happy they get anything that works at all. And so, you know, user experience always was something that always sort of came in V later. And these guys are spending tons of time figuring out how do they make the marketplace incredibly useful for not just for developers who want to place their apps in the marketplace and generate revenue or at least get broad distribution, but how do we make it really useful for consumers? So how do we effectively integrate social networking like Twitter and Facebook? How do we create a reputation system so that the really good apps or the really useful apps bubble to the top? How do we create findability opportunities so that an app, once it's in the store, you know, is always going to be discoverable by the potential consumers that it will be of value to. And that's a, you know, that's sort of a really, you know, that's sort of an interesting science.
Well, back me up. The store that you're talking about would be, is this theory that's going to be propagated out into the industry, or is this a real store that's going to be part of the Gecko operating system?
So it's not going to be part of the Gecko operating system. But apart from that, it's both of what you said. So it is going to be first an open source implementation. So if you want to take the source code and set up your own store, you can do that. So we are also going to run what we think will be the largest instance of that marketplace. And so, you know, for example, we're going to have a curation process, and there are some things that in Mozilla's instance of that store won't be listed. So, for example, you know, there are obvious things. Pornography, for example, won't be listed. Now, maybe you want to create a store of that nature. That's okay. You can take the code and do your own thing. But one of the things that we think is an interesting opportunity is that the marketplace will be exposed to anybody that wants to go to the marketplace. And you can actually go see it's open for application submission already. So the developer side is open. The consumer side's not open yet. You can go to marketplace.mozilla.org and you can log in using browser ID, or actually now called Persona, which is a single sign-on system for the World Wide Web. That's also a Mozilla product. And you can, you know, log in you can even submit your own HTML5 app if you like. So, when the consumer side goes live, in addition to, you know, the whole World Wide Web that can go to the Mozilla Marketplace online, the marketplace will be exposed through Firefox on Mac, Windows, Linux, and Android. So depending on how you count it, that's something like 450 million users on the first day that the marketplace is open to consumers. So the second largest app marketplace is the Android marketplace, which is tracking at about 50 million. The iOS marketplace is about 33 million. So we think, you know, one of the opportunities is that we can leverage the really large collection of browser consumers that use Firefox to expose apps to, you know, somewhere just short of a half a billion users. And that's just to get started.
And that's just to get started. That's great. Those are big numbers. I'm interested in these apps. What's the nature of the development of these apps? Is that an open to whatever folks want to build, or is that constrained to specific operating systems, or how does that work?
We have lots of discussion about that. The basics are it's a HTML5, CSS, JavaScript app. But beyond that, for example, you might build an app that is that has specific dependency on a given form factor, like a tablet, or a given specific device. That's okay, and we're talking about and actually the engineering folks are doing some work to enable. So you might be able to specify, hey, this only works on tablets that have a specific screen resolution. One of the things, a lot of media providers, so folks that, for example, rent videos, they're interested in DRM. There's no DRM functionality in HTML5, so you know they may choose to embed in their HTML5 app a Flash player that handles that specific need for them. And yeah, that's okay. So, I mean, the idea is...
So it's okay if they add digital rights management, even though that's not something you're inherently supporting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that sort of can be wrong with any developer ecosystem that wants to distribute is for the marketplace to be too intrusive in terms of telling the developer what they can and can't do, right? So, you know, there are some places that are pretty easy to make those decisions, you know, things that are illegal, things that violate, you know, copyright or, you know, trademark or other intellectual property laws or, you know, for the most part, you know, we don't want to be any more restrictive than is absolutely necessary.
What else should I know about what you're doing in Mozilla?
Browser ID, now called Persona.
Okay.
Browser ID is sort of what we call the infrastructure technology, but Persona is the consumer side name. And the idea around Persona is that, it's as I mentioned before, it's single sign-on for the World Wide Web. And the cool thing about this is that you'll register once with Persona. And so in order to do that, you'd specify a username and a password. So you'd create an account. And then having done that, any site that uses Persona will prompt you for an email address. But it doesn't have to be the email address that you created your account with, right? So think about what that means, right? So for example, I have two professional personalities. One is in the technology space, and the other is in the defensive tactics and law enforcement training space, right? So that's sort of my hobby job. Those two things are pretty different and in many ways are mutually exclusive. So I don't want to have, you know, one identity that I present both sets of websites that I register at. With Persona, I can create my account and then I can specify however many personas I want. And a persona basically equates to an email address. And it doesn't, you know, there are no specific requirements around whatever email address I specify. And then what that means is that when I go to a website that uses the browser ID technology, it'll say, you know, and I'm logged into Persona. If I'm not logged into Persona, it will ask me to log in. But once I've authenticated, when I go to a website that uses browser ID for authentication, it will say, hey, what persona do you want to authenticate to this website with? And I get to choose. Does that make sense? It's a little hard to explain without visuals, but.
No, that makes good sense. But it depends on sufficient number of websites participating.
Sure.
So how is this, help me understand how this is different from OpenID.
Well, so there are a couple of things, and I'm not an OpenID expert, but the one of the big things is that you can have a single set of authentications. You only have to log into the internet once, but you can present as many personas as you'd like, or whichever persona you'd like to any website that makes a browser ID request for authentication. The other thing is that it's a completely open standard, and we're doing a lot to make it easy for website developers to include authentication support based on persona in their website. The other thing that's sort of interesting is that as you can imagine, the whole apps infrastructure is sort of a huge big deal, both from a philosophical perspective as well as from a technical perspective. And one of the things that we need to be able to do is to provide for developers that want them a monetary acquisition mechanism. So there are a bunch of different reasons that people will distribute apps, right? So for example, if you're United Airlines, you're going to build an app and you're probably not going to sell it, right? You're going to use that app to improve the customer service experience of your customers. So you're not going to charge for it. You might not even put revenue earning in-app advertisement in that app, but you want the broadest possible distribution mechanism because you want every one of your customers to get access to that app so that you can improve customer service and decrease customer service costs, right? So, but there are other folks that are going to want to earn money from their app. And, there are obviously two primary models for that. One is in-app revenue. So the app itself is free, but you get people to buy or upgrade or whatever inside the app. Or there's the other model where you just charge some amount of money for the application. In order to do that, though, and in order to enforce that from an open web apps perspective, we needed to come up with some sort of a receipting mechanism so that the app could make request verification that user has acquired that app. And all of that is based on browser ID and persona as well. And one of the cool things about that is that unlike the conventional model where you have to buy an app, you have to pay for an app that is a paid app on each device that you want to use it on, the idea of open web apps is you acquire the right to use the app, and then you can use it on any device that you have. So the cool thing about that is maybe I'm at an airport. I can log into the My Apps container on the site, and I can run all the apps even if I haven't installed them on the local device because I'm at a kiosk. I can also use Firefox Sync if I'm a Firefox user to sync those apps across devices, and all of that works because of browser ID.